Radio.
Confessions of a Geek Priest, a talk by Father Roderick von Hogan, a theology at the pub in Melbourne.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to share a few of my experiences here tonight on theology at the pub in this wonderful city. What, Melbourne is an amazing city. I didn't see that coming. I thought Sydney was fantastic. I loved Auckland, of course.
Yeah.
but Melbourne, wow! It's vibrant. It's colorful. It has all you want from a city. So my problem is, of course, I'm talking to a large group of people, most of which I don't know that much, and I don't know if you know anything about me. But I do know that there are also some people that have been following me since 2005 and that know probably more because of social networks and because of the podcast, know more about me than my own mother. So I want to apologize in advance if I'm skipping over things that you're like, where is this coming from? Or that I'm repeating stuff that you already have heard me say many, many times. But I figured I would just tell you a couple of stories that have really impacted my life and have contributed to my current work in the media. My bishop now has given me the mission to evangelize in both old and new media. So I work in television, I work in radio, but most of my work is done on the web and internationally. It's no longer confined to the frontiers of my parish or of the diocese. And I never thought that I would get to this point. Actually, I thought that becoming a priest would be the end of all that and the end of every adventure, and it would just be basically you being confined to a small village and then going from meeting to meeting to prayer session and to fights with choir A and fights with choir B. I mean, the whole concept of priesthood, I never associated that with traveling to Melbourne and talking in front of a crowd at theology at the pub. I never thought that adventure would be part of this life, but it did. And it's something that I think has always been a bit in my blood. And the first story I wanted to tell is about the way I grew up. So I'm born in the Netherlands, and well, you might know the Netherlands from the postcard pictures. You know, it's a green, flat landscape, some windmills at the horizon, some cows, tulips, Gouda cheese, all that. Well, it's true. That's where I was born. That was what the world looked like to me. And until this day, I never understood. I still don't understand why people travel the world to take pictures of that, because I thought it was the most boring country ever. It was flat. It was predictable. There were no mountains, no thick forests, no everything. You could see the horizon, so there is nothing to explore. It's like every town looks like the other one. Yes, it's beautiful. Yes, it has the tulips and the windmills, but they're all the same. And so as a child, I love to dream about fairy tales. My mom would always read stories to us when we were, you know, kids. And I still remember until today how we were lying in bed and we were sleeping, my brother and I, in the attic. And I still feel the prickly feeling of the sheets. And then she would sit down in between the beds and would start read a fairy tale. And you know, you just close your eyes and you're there. I was that prince who was going to fight that dragon to protect that wonderful, beautiful princess. Oftentimes we would fall asleep halfway through the story, and then the next day we would ask for the same story. My whole youth has been about stories and about these wonderful, and it started with fairy tales and then pirate stories. And then my mom, you know, trying to give us a Catholic education, started to read us Bible stories, which was okay. Was it no dragons? That was a bit of a disappointment. no knights, but still fascinating stories. I mean, Jesus walking over the water, and then it was really. But to me, it was all kind of part of this wonderful world that existed beyond reality. And I think that's why when Star Wars came around, that struck such a chord with me. I must have been 11 or 12, I think. Perhaps even a bit younger. When the first Star Wars movie, which was just called Star Wars, later on they added Star Wars 4, but at the time it was just Star Wars, was premiering in the Netherlands. And I had only seen one other movie in theaters before that, and it was Jesus Christ Superstar. And that had made a huge impression on me. I only knew Jesus from church. I was an altar boy, and so we would hear those stories. I remember the stories my mom told us before we went to sleep. And then we had this huge painting on the wall behind the tabernacle of Jesus on the cross. And when the homily was a little bit long, I would always stare at that. It was like, oh my goodness. But it was a very kind of static picture in my mind. And then we saw Jesus Christ Superstar with all the hippies and the dancing, and Jesus had this amazing singing voice, and it was very dynamic, and I just loved it. I totally thought that was exactly what happened. That was Jesus. And these apostles, wow, they could sing. And of course Herod was a bad guy. I mean, clearly, with those awful sunglasses, he must be. I think it really helped me get a more like a real picture. Jesus became not just someone from the stories, like the people in the fairy tales, but I could imagine that he was, had been walking around, and it made it much more relatable. And it's only later on that I discovered that, the apostles weren't the hippies as they are portrayed in that musical. And I'm not even sure if Jesus would sing like that, but Jesus became at that point a bit of a hero in my mind. I was like, that is someone whose example I would like to follow. However, when Star Wars came around, we went to The Hague. We didn't have a theater in our village. The Hague was a big city. We would always go there for shopping, and we would always eat Italian ice cream. It was a city that I associated with just positive things, kind of what Melbourne is now to me. It's like only positivity. There's nothing negative associated to the name Melbourne. And so just the excitement of going there. And my brother actually was too young to see Star Wars. So that was our first white lie, because I was the older brother, and couldn't do it to him that I could see that exciting movie, and he couldn't. So we just smuggled him in, and we saw Star Wars, and it was amazing. I'd never seen something like that, and especially what struck me was that story of Luke Skywalker, who is this boy on a farm planet. It's a desert planet. He's a farm boy. And just like in Holland, Tatooine is flat. and you can see the horizon, and nothing ever happens. Every year resembles the previous one, and Luke Skywalker's complaining about that to his uncle. He's an adopted kid. His father, well, his parents apparently have died. We don't know exactly the story there. Every time he proposes to do something exciting, like going to Tashi Station to pick up some power converters, his uncle is like, yeah, you can play with your friends later, but first help me with the harvest. And so he is stuck, and I felt like, that's me. I'm stuck here on this planet. What am I doing here? I should be slaying dragons, or at least walk over water. Then Luke Skywalker gets this call to adventure, and it's Obi-Wan Kenobi, this kind of monk-like old person who tells him that actually, he's not called to stay on that planet. He should be a Jedi, just like his father. And for the first time, he realizes that his father, did something amazing. And it creates this longing in his heart to follow in those footsteps and become a Jedi himself as well. Well, the story, that's what happens. And he gets to save a princess and gets to make, becomes friends with a Wookiee and a smuggler. And it's just this amazing adventure story. And that, from that moment on, Jesus was actually relegated to, you know, I don't know. It's just Luke Skywalker became what Jesus was before. And I was like, Luke Skywalker, that's so cool. And if only the Bible would have lightsabers. And so we had the toys and we played all this. We created our own stories. And it was just an amazing time. And I still remember with fondness the day that my sister got on board and she got her first Princess Leia doll for Christmas or for Santa Claus. We have Sinterklaas. And that made her part of our group, you know. She was finally our real sister because she too was into Star Wars. And then I'll jump ahead years and years and years. This was after Star Wars had faded away and, you know, Return of the Jedi. After that, no more Star Wars. And we thought, that's it. No more movies. And then this was about, 16, 17 years ago. I had just been ordained a priest. I might tell you that story another time, how that came about. I was ordained a priest, and I had always lived in cities, but I was asked to work in a tiny village in the center of the country. And when I looked out of the window of my presbytery, it would be exactly the same view as I had when I was a child. It's just the horizon, a windmill, some cows. And it was literally one of the smallest villages in the country. And I felt cut off of the entire world. The only symbol of communication with the outside world was an old telephone booth in front of the church. And it would get destroyed every weekend because of the, you know, people getting drunk and needing something to destroy. And and it's really hard to describe how isolated I felt. I was a young priest, a relatively young, 28 years old. But already at the time, we had an incredible lack of priests. And so my bishop just put me there in that village, basically without a guide, without an older priest, without a team. And it's just you go ahead and be priestly, which is really hard if you have no examples, if you have no experience whatsoever. Not to mention that in that village, they had had many priests before me. And so, like, there is always this mythological priest in the minds of the people. It's usually your predecessor or the one before him. However, that priest in their mind has nothing to do with the real person. It's an idealized version. And they expect you to become that same superhero who is always nice, who's always patient, who is always ready to do exactly what they want, and you know, has an unfailing admiration for the local customs. I don't know. I just, it's like, what am I going to do here? And how am I... It's like, how can I fit in? How can I realize my ideals? Because it felt like almost as if someone had pushed the reset button and I was back where I started as a child. And, you know, is this it? I was very disappointed in a way. And then I rediscovered Star Wars. And it was at the university. The internet was just starting to become a little bit more accessible. So the library, the university library, had a computer with internet. And I think at the time, the browser was Netscape. It was very old. And I remember always using the library computer, not really for research or anything, but to just go to Yahoo, and then I would, you know, look for science fiction stuff or whatever. And then I discover all these Star Wars websites, and they are all talking about this new movie that's coming out. George Lucas is going to do prequels. So he's going to tell the story of Darth Vader when he was a kid and how he turned into this Dark Lord. And I was like, it's back. And there are thousands of Star Wars fans just like me all around the world, and I can actually talk Star Wars with them. And so I started to read all the rumors about the movies. And then I got the idea, well, why don't people just
take all these rumors and try to piece together the story. Should be possible to kind of guess what the story is going to be. We already know a lot from the existing one, so yeah. And so in my naivete, I was like, well, I should build a website, and just create like a virtual edition of what these prequel movies might talk about. And so I built my very first website in GeoCities. I mean, it's a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. It was all manually programmed, you know, every page you had to hand code. And so I started to speculate about the movie. And in addition to that, I would create these graphics. So at one point we started to figure out who would star in the movie, so I knew that Liam Neeson would play an older Jedi. So I just cut out like a photo of Liam Neeson in the movie Rob Roy, and I would paste him on a Jedi outfit of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and then paste some stars and lightsabers in the background, and just trying to imagine what the movie could look like. And bit by bit, that website got a huge following. More and more people started to talk about it, and also started to send in feedback and were helping me figure out the story. And it got to a point that I was getting thousands of hits every day, and so that was kind of almost like a second identity. So by daylight, I would be this parish priest on my bike going from, you know, farm to farm and baptizing children and burying the dead and, you know, preaching way too long with homilies that never ended, with tons of theology. I would, you know, homilies of 5 pages. Never do that anymore. And by night, I would sit in my pajamas and I would be online chatting via ICQ, which was like one of the first chat clients, with a guy who lived in Canada. And that was when he was awake, and we would work on this Star Wars website. And then I got invited by another big Star Wars fan site to join their team. It's very Star Wars-y, like, join us, and together we will rule the fan galaxy. So I gave in to the dark side, and I became member of the Force.net, which was huge at the time. I think leading up to the movies, we would get, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of hits every day. Not to mention that the industry was watching us closely and was watching my side also, because we'd gotten so much information that we were getting pretty close to the actual movie. And at one point, we even got a conference call with Rick McCallum, who was producer for Star Wars, and their, you know, PR guy and a lawyer. And they were negotiating with us, and we were just fans, just, you know, amateurs. But they were actually begging us, so don't publish everything, and what if we give you some previews and some photos from the set, and you check with us if you can post a rumor. They were very afraid that someone else would take the story and would produce a very quick version of The Phantom Menace before, you know, the official movie would come out. And I still remember that I was walking around with that, you know, one of the first mobile phones that I had, and I was pacing back and forth in the presbytery, looking out of the window, and I saw the cows and the windmills, and I was like, I am on the phone with Lucasfilm. It was just, I was just shaking with excitement. It's like, I never thought that this would happen to me. And then the summit of all that was that I got an invitation from the guys at the Force.net to join them for the premiere, to come to the U.S. But, you know, I was a priest, and didn't really have the money to pay for, you know, like an extended stay in the U.S. and for the flight and everything. I wouldn't dare ask my bishop for funds. He was not aware that I was doing this. Nobody knew that I was doing this, except for my brother and perhaps my parents. But it was literally almost like a secret life, like with Superman, and, you know, he's Clark Kent, and he's Superman. I had that same feeling, like, underneath my black thing, I have this Star Wars t-shirt. The Force be with you. It's very funny how things work. And now I would say perhaps it was Providence, I don't know. But I get this phone call from a science fiction magazine in L.A., and a very nerdy magazine. I could tell from the website, it was all about TV series that I had even heard of, hadn't even heard of. But they wanted to do a whole segment about the prequels and about the story, and they stumbled upon my website. And they were like, well, you know, we would like to use some of your illustrations. So I go back to the guys of TheForce.net, the All-Americans, and they were, you should charge some money. I was like, really? I'm just so honored that they want to print my, you know, Photoshop creations. No, you should negotiate. And, you know, they're rich. Go ahead and just ask for some money. So I'm on the phone, and it's like, do you have any budget to, you know, to license the pictures? I was trying to use the lingo that they taught me. I felt very uncomfortable. I mean, I'm this priest, and I'm, like, talking about licensing illustrations. And of course we want to pay. And so I was like, what did you have in mind? And they were like, $500? I was like, wow, sure, great. $500, something I did in my spare time, you know, just messing around with Photoshop. Sure, that's awesome. What I didn't know that they meant 500 per picture, and they were going to use 35. So that funded my trip to the U.S. It was crazy. I still didn't tell my bishop. So I'm sitting there in my jacuzzi the next day. just kidding. But it enabled me to travel to the U.S. And they told me, oh, you got to come to the first Denver Star Wars celebration. It was a new marketing idea that Lucasfilm had. Let's organize a party around the new Star Wars movies. Let's get all these Star Wars fans together, and they will help us promote the movie. That was when the movie industry, started to understand how important it was to use the fans on the internet to spread the word and you know, hype it up. Nowadays, it's kind of very commonplace. At the time, it was a novel idea. Most movie companies were afraid of the fans, and there were problems with, there was this one guy, Harry Knowles, and he had Ain't It Cool. And he published some photos of alien designs for a Sony movie, and then Sony sued him. And Lucasfilm took the other approach. It's like, well, no, let's just, you know, fuel the fans. Literally, let's just fuel the fire, and let's see what these fans can do for us. So they organized this big convention in Denver. I had never been to a science fiction convention ever. Actually, I'd never been in a group of more than two Star Wars fans, my brother and I. So I get to Denver, and it was happening outside of Denver on a former Air Force base, and I was wearing my Star Wars, not my Star Wars, my my clerics, my black shirt and white collar, and I felt very out of place because I was surrounded by people in stormtrooper outfits, and Darth Vader was there, and people in, you know, with makeup and pointy ears, and all greeting you with "May the Force be with you," and oh gosh, like at least 25 Princess Leia's in metal bikinis from the third movie, but it was just very just a fascinating world, and I just like I felt so out of place, But at the same time, I was just so excited to be in this other world. It was such a contrast with the parish at home. At that point, I had already told the people that were following me that I was a priest, which in the beginning I didn't really advertise. But then when the movie started to know more about the first movie, and I saw so many religious parallels and themes in there, just like in the existing Star Wars movies, that I started to blog about that. I was like, you know what? Anakin is kind of like, it's an archetype of the same. You see the same thing with Jesus when he was young, and then you get the temptations of the devil. Well, in a way, Anakin is also tempted, but the difference with Jesus is he falls for it, etc. So I started to write these more kind of religious takes on Star Wars, and had already received quite a bit of feedback from people that were like, that is so cool that a priest is into Star Wars. That for many people, that was so special in a way, and it felt them. It lowered the threshold, and it made me. It made them look at me more like, "Oh, this priest is one of us." So, they actually started to send me emails with questions about faith or whatever. There were lots of Catholics also that were, "Gosh, we never thought that you could combine those two worlds." And they felt, in a way, supported by my geeky behavior. So I was working around there, and at one point, I entered this tent where they have all these things for sale, you know, like all the gimmicks and the gadgets with Star Wars logos and overpriced. And then I hear a guy calling my name, Father Roderick! And I was, who is calling? Who knows that I'm here? And then this guy walks up to me. Do you know who I am? I was like, no. I'm Rob. Rob so-and-so. I was like, Rob so-and-so? That's a weird name. I'm your biggest fan. And then he calls his wife and his children. Like, his youngest daughter was dressed up as Padme Amidala, including the white face and the red robe. And then his youngest kid was a Jedi with a green lightsaber and everything. Kids, this is Father Roderick. I was like, hi. and then he tells me, he's a truck driver, and he always travels between the East Coast and the West Coast. So that's a very long drive. And then he goes on to tell me, and I'm not kidding you, the first thing I do when I come home, I don't even kiss my wife. I go to the computer and I go see what you've posted on your website and what I've missed, because I need to get up to date with Star Wars. So you've been my personal hero. His wife was less enthusiastic to see me. but then he goes on to tell me that because of the of me doing that website, his children got interested, so he couldn't stop talking about the virtual edition and about this Father Roderick. So his kids were like, well, why don't we ever go to church? We could ask our priest if he's into Star Wars. And so it was actually the kids forced the parents to go to church, so they talked with their local priest. He didn't even know what Star Wars was. But it stuck. It was a nice guy. So first contact was made, and they kept going back to church and actually kind of reverted to the Catholic faith, and we're now going to church every week. And he's like, are you aware that it all started with your Star Wars website? And if you hadn't done that, we would have never been back in the church. And that's when you realize,
the power of the dark side.
The power of the internet is like, I had no idea that was happening. And I wasn't really deliberately evangelizing. I was just present in that other world, talking the language and talking about the topics that we had in common with all those Star Wars fans. And in a way, in retrospect, I think that God was using that and was acting and was reaching these people. And so once you hear a story like that, you start to look at these people around you in a very different way. Like, in a way, those stormtroopers over there are my virtual parishioners. Who is taking care of these Star Wars fans? Who's representing the church in that milieu? Well, I was at that moment. And so that helped me feel at ease. And I had a lot of other encounters like that. I still hadn't told my bishop. He got to find out. I'll get to that. So I was in Siberia. And the cool thing was that I started to discover during that conference that a lot of people were following the website, including the guys from Lucasfilm. There were people from Industrial Light and Magic that told me that they were checking the website. And I had already like mock-up pictures of the pod race, and they were still in the design phase. It was like, one guy told me, if you weren't a priest, we would have hired you right there and then. Like, oh! And then I get this email, and I was going to travel from Denver to Dallas, and most of the guys from the Force.net were based in Texas. And then I get this email from one of the people that apparently was reading my website, and he happened to work for Lucasfilm. And he said, if you're ever in the area of San Francisco, I can give you a tour of Skywalker Ranch. Now, for those of you that are not into Star Wars or Lucasfilm, Skywalker Ranch is the most, it's like the ultimate place for Star Wars fans, especially around that time when everything was so secret, and And there were even fans that were trying to climb over the fences and would get hunted down by dogs and everything. It's this beautiful area. It's north of San Francisco. So if you cross the Golden Gate Bridge, you enter this beautiful Marin County with hills and roll. If you've seen The Phantom Menace, and you have that battle at the end with the Gungans, the Jar Jars, and the battle droids. You've got some homework there. Anyway, that landscape is exactly Marin County. It looks like the hills there. And George Lucas, at one point, he didn't like Hollywood. He didn't like, you know, the industrial way in which movies were made. He's like, I think that stories are born in a beautiful environment. Beauty is the foundation for creativity. And so he created what he called the Skywalker Ranch. It basically looks like an old-fashioned ranch from the 19th century with lots of nice Victorian houses and little lakes, and it's wonderful. He even has his own vineyard. And he had the sound division was there, so Ben Burtt, who does all the big sound effects for the blockbusters. So he had his own building there. And then you had the big main house where George Lucas would work with the special effects people. And it was so closed off that, you know, you never heard stories. Everybody was like, oh, what would it be there? Every fan would love to be there. And then I get this guy who just like, you know, I can show you around because I work here and, you know, I'll get you the permissions. So I just booked a flight to San Francisco. I was like, okay, I got to do this. And I got the tour, and I remember walking there, and we were entering the house, the main house. And there's this glass display, and it has Indiana Jones's whip. And it's sitting right there next to that little egg-shaped golden thing that he steals in the first movie, you know, when the whole grotto starts to collapse. It was right there in front of me. I was like, oh. If I could have leached the window, I would have done it. I've said this often before. I've been lucky enough to shake hands with both Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict. However, being there was a lot cooler. So much cooler. So yeah, the Vatican is really great, but you know, being there in the Skywalker Ranch, it was. Just for a geek like me, it was the ultimate thing. I started to continue to have these contacts with people from all over the world. The thing that I learned there was that it ultimately pays off to venture into these areas where the church normally is not expected and is not present. And instead of trying to get people to come to you and to learn your language, sometimes evangelization is about doing the opposite. It's going out of your church, out of your own subculture, because ultimately we are a subculture, just like the Twi'leks and the droids. We have our own language, we have our own customs, our own culture. But sometimes it pays off to go out of that safe environment and try to meet people where they're at. And for me, being a geek, it was kind of the natural thing to go to the geeks. And so many years later, I still have to say, tell the story of how my bishop discovered that I was into Star Wars. It was when one of his collaborators, and they knew that I had some hobby with internet. And I still remember, I had this conversation with a lady who was the head of communications in the Archdiocese, and she had worked for years in television. And at one point she tells me, you know, Father Roderick, you're not really taking that internet thing seriously, do you? That's, you know, the old media are here to stay. People will not switch from television to another medium. Let me tell you, the internet, it's a fad. It's going away. 5 years from now, you'll come to and see me and tell me you were right. The internet, who talks about it anymore? I really don't think this is a fad. I think it's here to stay. And I think this is a huge tool for evangelization. Because I was a priest in one of the smallest villages in Holland. I wasn't Tatooine, and at the same time, I was reaching tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Star Wars fans, and it might be the only point of contact between them and the church. So I was like, if we can find a few more people that can do this, you know, we could reach millions of people. And so they were all kind of like, it's a hobby. It's Father Roderick with his internet stuff. And I would actually get nasty letters from, letters, not emails, from fellow priests, handwritten letters telling me that that was not appropriate for a priest to be involved in, you know, in all these online forums and to waste my time with science fiction. Instead, I should visit people and, you know, preach and pray as if I wasn't doing that. And that hurt, and it made me feel a bit insecure. You know, am I doing the right thing? And it was, I think, thanks to most of those emails that I would get back, that sometimes you would see the fruits of what you were trying to do, that it was a confirmation that, yes, this is worth exploring, and this might be something for the, that will grow even more in the church in the future. And so at one point, there was this collaborator, another collaborator of the bishop, and he always was boasting about how much he was in touch with the international business world. He was the finances guy. And so he would read Business Week, Newsweek, and then there was another business magazine. And one of those magazines happens to have done a big interview with me while I was at the Denver conference about the business of fan websites. And there was this spread in the middle of the magazine with my picture there, my photo, and then a whole analysis of online fandom and whatnot and what the church was trying to do with new media. And so I'm visiting the Archdiocese, and he walks up and he shows me the magazine. He's like, "How on earth did you get into Business Weekly?" And that's when he talked to the bishop and is like, "Yeah, I think this hobby of Father Roderick is a little bit bigger than we all thought it was." And then a couple of years later, I'm sent to Rome and I'm studying social communications. And again, I was sent to Rome to do a doctorate about Hans Urs von Balthasar in dogmatic theology, which I love. I love systematic theology or dogmatic theology. And I was going to write a thesis about the communion of saints, which I think is a beautiful, beautiful concept, and it deserves to be explored. And Hans Urs von Balthasar had written some beautiful stuff about that. So, full of courage, I had been given 2 years to write that thesis. I love to be in Rome. And, you know, it's such an amazing city. And I was very enthusiastic. And then, like the first week of introduction, when we were still learning the Italian and, you know, how to order pizza in Italian and how to swear when you're in a taxi, or how to understand the swearing of the taxi driver, basically, I saw this flyer. It was an ad for an institute on the top floor of the building of the Gregorian University. And it was a two-year course in social media or social communications. And it had pictures with students sitting behind mixing boards and carrying big television cameras around. And it had this really, it was written by communication experts. So it was very exciting what I read. It's like, you can, and actually they made it seem as if you could combine that study with any other study that you were already doing at the same university, which was confirmed by the head of the institute. He said, your bishop is already paying for your doctorate. So, you know, it's just a little, it's just a few hours every week and you'll like it, you know, just come on, just write your name down here. Don't look at the fine print. And then you're fine. You'll enjoy it. Turned out that this was a full-time formation, 2 years. And it was training in journalism, radio production, television production, internet. It had everything. And it had sociology courses in there, so it was about mass media, and I discovered that there was a whole science of how to communicate, how to tell stories, how to use the language of radio and internet and journalism and to convey your message in an effective way. That's my duck, by the way. It's usually the duck telling me that I have to stop talking, but I'll wrap up this story. So the For me, it was a revelation to discover that communication is not just something you make up as you go. It's not just a hobby. It is actually, it's a craft. It's something that you can learn and that you can master to a certain degree. Of course, you need to have some basic creativity, but a lot of the mistakes that we make in Catholic communication are because we're ignorant. We don't use the same techniques that the world is using very effectively. And we are never striving to get to the quality level that all the other media are using for ultimately a message that is much less important than the message that we have. So I'm always like, why? If we have the most important message in the world, in the history of the world, why do we wrap it in rags or in old newspapers? Why don't we invest in quality? We used to build cathedrals. And look at the websites right now of parishes. It's, you know, blue background, Comic Sans fonts, moving GIFs. The priest on the main page has been dead for 5 years. Why? Why can't we be like George Lucas and believe that if we have a beautiful message, we need to create beauty? We need to create an environment where creativity can flourish. And I was discovering that in Rome, and I was sold. So I started to do television production courses, and I did even way more than I was supposed to do. And I was doing these courses for 16 hours per day almost. Like television was such a huge amount of work. I spent sometimes entire nights locked up in the basement of the Jesuits there. Behind an always crashing Avid editing computer, trying to, you know, make the deadline for my homework for the next day. But I loved it. I was like, this is what we are bad at, and this is what I'm learning here. It's not, we don't have, you know, we have a beautiful message. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that we don't know how to transmit it, how to convey it in a good way, in a quality way, in a way that is interesting and fascinating to the people that might not know that message. But I had the problem that my bishop didn't know that I was doing this other study. He was still thinking that I was writing that thesis for, you know, about Hans Urs von Balthasar and the communion of saints. So basically, less deja vu. And then the other priests were scandalized. You know, like, you can't do this. Your bishop is paying for this, and you're doing something totally different. Obedience, and, you know. So my bishop is also a cardinal, came over for a commission, and he visited us one by one and was like, oh gosh, and now it's confession time. I need to fess up and tell him that again I've been doing something that was not part of my original mission. And so I sit down, and I had thought of this whole, how am I going to communicate this? And I was like, okay, let's start with common ground. We have the communion of saints, and I told him, you know, I was originally planning on writing this thesis about the communion of saints, about this bond that we have, this spiritual connection with both heaven, the heavenly church, and also already here on earth. If we pray for each other, we live that communion of the saints, and all the good things that are happening and the graces that are given are shared among all of us, and so it's beautiful. However, dear Cardinal, dear Monsignor, dear Excellency, I have discovered that before you can get to the communion of saints, you need to get you need to have those relationships. And in order to create those relationships and to grow the church and to grow that communion of the church, perhaps first of all, we need the communication of saints and the communication. And so I was coming across this little flyer and it talked about communication, and I've been doing a few courses here and there, and I really think it's quite interesting. And I'm thinking of switching to doing that instead of doing the thesis. Like, I was preparing for the worst. I think he's gonna take me back on the plane and just put me back at that village there, and it's gonna be all over. And to my great surprise, and this is something that he's done after that as well, he sits back and he's like, you know what? I think you're right. We have, you know, I was excited when I heard you were going to do a thesis in theology, but if I'm perfectly honest, I actually thought, another one? We already have so many theologians. But what we don't have is people that are able to, you know, talk to the media and communicate and do all the website stuff and all that digital thing. Those digital things that you're doing, he really wasn't into the digital world, but he actually gave me permission and encouraged me to switch studies and to do that full time, which was a huge relief. And I was like, oh, that is so good. It's as if, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi gives you a pat on the back and you're like, yeah, come on, just hold the lightsaber a little bit more like that and you'll be fine. And so that's kind of, after a year, another year there in Rome, I came back with all this knowledge about communication, about filmmaking or editing and radio production. And I was like, so what now? Why, you know, a priest on television, that's not going to fly. That's never going to happen. A priest on the radio, forget about it. Who wants to listen to a priest on the radio? And that's when this whole podcasting thing came about. And it was one of my parishioners who told me about it. I was like, gosh, that is so awesome. I could make radio and distribute it via the internet and people can listen with their iPod. And so that's how I started to do radio shows. And I started podcasting in the Vatican, and it happened to be at the time that John Paul II fell ill. And I was just going to the hospital and reporting on it. And it was like an eyewitness report from the perspective of a Catholic priest. So you can't get more subjective. But people were eating it up because it was so different from what you would see on CNN or ABC. And you'd always hear the same stories over and over. And now people were able to actually follow me along while I was sitting in that taxi trying to get to the Gemelli Hospital. And I was standing there on St. Peter's Square the night that Pope John Paul II died. And it was one of the most emotional moments in my life. And I was able to let thousands of people share in the emotion of that moment by just having this. It was exactly this recorder, exactly the same. I was walking around with that, recorded everything and posted online, and the next day thousands of people were downloading that. And I was there when the conclave took place, and there are many stories that I can tell. That's why I wrote this book, Geek Priest, because I was like, gosh, there's so many stories to tell. But, you know, one time I snuck into the Vatican gardens and bumped into Cardinal Ratzinger right before the beginning of the conclave, and I was like whispering in my hidden microphone, like, that could be the next pope. And a couple of days later, you know, the doors open, and lo and behold, I told you so! Ratzinger! And it was just an amazing adventure. And the more I did that, the more people started to listen to that. It was showing the Catholic Church from an angle that people had no knowledge of. It's literally taking them behind the scenes, telling them what the church is really about, and sharing the adventure that I felt I was living with so many other people. And that's kind of been the way that I've been doing new media up until today, even with YouTube now, with the videos. It's very much like podcasting, but this time I'm just holding a video camera. And I was on St. Peter's Square during the election of Pope Francis. And I remember we were standing in the rain, and it was already getting dark, and we still had no smoke. And I had been standing there since 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was just one of those moments where you kind of get this gut feeling that perhaps tonight's the night. I think that's a song, isn't it? And I had this very small collapsible umbrella. It was way too small. And I was holding this digital recorder in one hand with the umbrella. And then I had my camera in the other hand, trying to film the chimney from underneath the umbrella and avoiding the rain getting onto my equipment. And then the moment the white smoke starts to appear, the rain stops. It was like magic. It was literally as if we were in Hollywood and someone just flipped the switch and no more rain. So I quickly get rid of my umbrella and start filming everything. And then you have that moment when you see this, you know, we all had our lists of who was going to be the next pope. And then he's like, and his name is Cardinal Bergoglio. I was like, oh gosh, that's the only name that I don't know, and I have no idea what to say. Unfortunately, some other people in my vicinity knew who he was, and I could interview them. And then I just ran across the square after his initial talk was over, and I started interviewing every young person that I found, and I got these amazing, like, on-the-spot reactions of people that were so emotional and so, like, joyful, I still choke up when I see that video. It's like, it's so immediate and so convincing, and that video just went viral. It's just, and I would have never been able to do that if I hadn't had just that tiny equipment that you have nowadays, and let people share in the excitement and in the adventure. And there, and you don't have to preach, you just show. And that's enough to really make a mark. And well, I really need to wrap this up to give some time for a Q&A, but that's why I'm so excited that today in Melbourne, we had our first day of the Catholic New Media Conference. Because I've seen how much this kind of media is the media of the future. And we no longer have to wait until the big companies will, you know, bow down from the heavens where they are and point their microphone to get one quote. Yeah, I think the Pope is cool. Oh, thank you for that insight. And so you think the Pope is not cool. Let me give you half an hour to say why not. We don't have to be in that position anymore. We can take control of the media. We can make our own media. We can make radio. We can make television, high-quality productions. The technology is almost free right now. The distribution can be global. What are we waiting for? We should grab this. We should do the bishops should invest in this. And we asked one of the people at the conference asked Bishop Porteous the question, what to do? Or he asked one of us, I think. No, it was Porteous. What do you do when you know you're in a diocese or in a parish where people don't see that and they don't want to use new media and they're not interested? And he said, well, you know what? Look at what Pope Francis is doing with his tweets, the way he communicates. The Vatican right now is on the forefront of new media. They've invited people from Google and Facebook and just to teach them how to use these media. They created that Pope app, which created the most internet traffic for one event in the history of the internet, I think. It was just incredible. And so, other than you would expect, the Vatican right now is leading the way, showing us that it can be done and that it can be effective. And I think that that is going to be a huge support for all of us here in Australia or in New Zealand or even in places like the Netherlands to embrace these new media, take control of our message, and make sure that if people are confronted with our message, that it's presented to them in the most attractive, most fun, most creative way possible. I think that the apostles, if they would have our technology that we have nowadays, they would be all over it. And so that's my big hope, that these days here in Melbourne can trigger that and can incentivize us to work together to, you know, get to the next level with our communications. Thank you so much for your time.
That was Father Roderick von Hogan with Confessions of a Geek Priest. Theology at the Pub is held at the Pump House Hotel in Fitzroy, Melbourne. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.